Welcome to Out of Bounds. I'm Tish Perlman. My guest is Victor Picard. Picard is currently an associate professor in the Annenberg School of Communications at the University of Pennsylvania. He previously taught media studies at NYU and the University of Virginia and worked on media policy in Washington, D.C. He is the author of an important and well-researched book on media history and policy in the U.S. It's called America's Battle for Media Democracy, The Triumph of Corporate Libertarianism, and the Future of Media Reform. It was published by Cambridge University Press in 2015, and it's what we will be discussing today. Welcome.
Thanks for having me, Tish.
Now, your book was really fascinating. I've been wondering how we came to the point we're at right now, and your book explains it, because we've gone full circle, it seems. Your book mainly talks about the 1940s and the fights for diversity and the anger about commercialization. So talk to us, how did you get interested in looking into this history?
Yeah, it's a little bit counterintuitive to focus on the 1940s. Historians are often drawn to political hotspots, the 1930s or the 60s. The 40s and 50s are kind of treated as flyover country in many ways. But I began with, as you noted, this big question, which is how did we inherit this particular kind of media system in the United States, a system that compared to other democracies is fairly unique. In many sectors, it's dominated by a handful of corporations. It's only lightly regulated in terms of public interest protections. And it's predominantly commercial, only offset by a very weak public media system. And so I wanted to figure out, how did this happen? And as I dug into the archives, it seemed that many of the roads led back to this moment in the 1940s, when so much was going on around defining our media system, how it should operate in a democratic society.
Yeah, and we're still trying to figure that out. You know what amazed me, too? Because I don't know that much about the history. That already we were dominated by four networks in the 1940s.
That's right.
That amazed me. And 5% were independents.
That's right. It sounds like a more recent problem. But in fact, this concern about media monopolies, about the loss of local journalism, this was very much relevant in the 1940s when you had social movement groups really grappling around these questions, trying to create a more democratic system. And yet it wasn't inevitable. You know, it's oftentimes we just assume what we have today was just sort of the natural development of things. But in fact, it was really contested back in the 40s. There were a lot of groups that didn't want to have these media monopolies and wanted to have a more socially responsible media system.
Yeah, yeah. So do you think it came down to, though, the fact that corporations had the money and it took money to make these programs? And I mean, it's the same thing that we talk about now.
That was a big part of it, definitely. They already had a lot of power. There was debate briefly in the 1930s. Many people aren't aware of this, but there was serious consideration of having a stronger public media system. It'd be an exaggeration to say that we could have had a BBC. But it was something that could have been closer to that than what we have today. And not to leave your listeners in suspense, the reformers were not successful in advocating for that. But what you had in the 40s, you had a lot of people who thought, okay, if it is going to be a commercial media system, there's got to be these public interest obligations. They've got to give something back to the public, especially since they're monopolizing the public airwaves.
Yeah, and a marketplace of ideas was the original idea that we needed, right?
I mean, that's right. Yeah, I mean, this comes out of, you know, liberal democratic theory 101, this idea that you have to have an open marketplace of ideas in order to have a healthy democratic society. And, you know, the fancy academic term for these debates is normative. You know, what are the normative assumptions that we have about our media system in a democratic society? And that's really what was being fought over and defined during the 1940s.
You know what amazed me, too, because, you know, we've all heard some of the old commercials and stuff, how commercial it was. I mean, these were long commercials. In an hour show, there'd be 15. And a lot of it was selling products, selling nationalism, selling propaganda about democracy. It's amazing to me.
Yeah, it was very propagandistic. But also, it's where we get this term soap operas. Soap operas were daytime dramas that were often sponsored by companies like soap companies. And back then, the companies that sponsored these programs actually co-produced them. I mean, you would even have plots written around, you know, smoking Lucky Strike cigarettes.
Yeah.
So, you know, I would say today it might not be quite as overt, although, of course, we have product placement and, you know, various forms of invasive and deceptive advertising. Back then, it was a little bit more overt. You even had these terms of derision. They called them plug uglies.
Yes,
and
I was going to
bring
that
jingles.
Up. Yeah.
And there were these national campaigns to try to drive these advertisements off the air because they were always interrupting people's favorite programs.
Yeah. But I was really interested in the propaganda aspect of it, too, because this country has always complained about Russia and North Korea being these closed societies filled with propaganda, Big Brother. We were doing the same things in the 1940s.
Absolutely. Yeah, we assume that doesn't happen here, but it arguably continues to happen. Again, usually in more subtle forms today, but definitely back then. And of course, during World War II, you had the big radio networks really trying to help out with the war effort. And at the same time, people were seeing what was happening in these fascistic countries like Nazi Germany and the role that radio played there in mobilizing people around these very odious ideologies. So there was, I think that fed into some of the criticism that was coming out in the 40s too, that you saw this commercial takeover of the public airwaves, and there was a reaction against that.
Yeah. Oh, God, it just gives me the chills when I think about it. You know, we are the best country in the world, you know? And that's not propaganda, though, right? Because we think we're right.
Right.
Talk about the fact that there were, in fact, FM stations that were doing cultural things. That's how Paul Robeson came to the fore. So, you know, it wasn't all commercial radio. There was a little bit of inroad into FM educational. To talk.
That's true. And as AM radio gave way, or I shouldn't say gave way, but was supplemented by FM radio, there was this meme going around, this idea of radio's second chance, that, you know, okay, AM was immediately taken over by these big radio monopolies. Now we have a second chance with FM radio. We can try to make it a little more socially responsible. But again, not to leave folks in suspense, that it didn't quite pan out that way, at least as reformers had hoped. And quickly, the same radio monopolies took over, sort of colonized FM radio. But you're right, you did have pockets of more socially responsible programming. And part of this was because the FCC really started coming down. The Federal Communications Commission, which is the main regulatory body that oversees a lot of our media system, especially broadcast media and telecommunications, the FCC really started to come down on these radio networks in the 1940s. And I think because of that, you saw sort of a nod to these public interest obligations.
But, you know, there was, you talk about this in the book quite extensively, they were trying to eradicate progressive voices all through this, too. I mean, calling them communists, calling them anti-American, saying if you don't like capitalism and you don't, you know.
Yeah.
So talk to us about how, that's amazing to me.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. It's a real turning point in the 1940s where prior to the mid-40s, you had somewhat of a ideological balance. That might be a bit of a stretch, but you definitely had more liberal commentators on the air. But then post-World War II, when Russia suddenly became our big enemy, you saw this anti-communist hysteria take hold. And I think we as a society haven't really reckoned with the lasting legacy that this period had on all of our core systems, whether we're looking at our healthcare system or, you know, our financial system, but especially around media, it left this lasting imprint where anything that government tried to do, no matter how innocuous it was, it could be easily dismissed as this sort of socialistic plot. And so this red baiting really drove out the progressives from Washington, D.C., drove them off the public airwaves, led to a purge throughout social movements. You saw this in the labor movement, the civil rights movement. All the progressives and the left-wing groups were pushed to the margins. And I think that just had this profound impact on our media system.
Yeah. And of course, we can't talk about the 1940s without talking about the lack of diversity and stereotypes of African Americans, hardly any women's voices.
Absolutely.
And even to this day, I hear men in broadcasting say women should not be on the airwaves because they don't sound like authorities and they have irritating voices. I've heard it over and over.
Yeah, that's terrible. And that was definitely taking place in the 40s. You had these various social movement groups who, you know, they came to this realization that regardless of what their first issue was, their second issue needed to be reforming the media system, because until they changed the media system, they weren't going to be able to get their voices into the national discourse. So you saw these media reform coalitions rise up throughout the 40s that really tried to – they wanted to change the media system, and they realized that to do that, they first had to change media policy. So even though some of these issues were somewhat wonky and technical, these groups realized that they really had to try to intervene. And fortunately, at least for a time, there were these progressive policymakers in D.C. that were very sympathetic to their objectives. And so you saw this inside-outside – you know, coordination happening for a brief moment in the 40s.
But I'm taken by, and I've heard some of the old programs and stuff, white people were depicting black people in these stereotypical voices. It was like verbal blackface.
Yeah. Exhibit A is Amos and Andy, a show that was so popular among white audiences, and it was caricatured African-American dialect. It was terribly racist. And I quote, you know, some letters to the FCC from African-American listeners, even returning World War II veterans who were just so appalled by what they were hearing, this racist programming on the air. So, yeah, that was a major part of the media criticism that was driving this reform movement in the 40s.
Yeah. I don't think you talk that much about it, but was there ever discussion about more women on the radio in those
absolutely.
Days?
Oh, yeah, no doubt. I mean, that was a major part of this media reform coalition. There were various feminist groups involved. And some of the most poignant letters that I cite in my book come from self-described housewives who felt, you know, sort of captive to this inane daytime programming. You know, not everyone, sure, the soap operas were very popular, but not everyone wanted to listen to them all the time.
Yeah.
And there was this sort of, you know, appeal to the lowest common denominator in a lot of the programming. So I feel like there was a strong feminist critique throughout the 40s as well against, you know, this really unintelligent and in many cases very sexist radio programming.
Yeah. And it comes back full circle, though. I mean, we're still talking about there aren't enough women directing movies. There aren't enough
women. These problems are still very much with us today. And again, I feel like this is a recurring theme. It was more, at least from our contemporary eyes, it was so much more overt back in the 40s. And therefore, it was easier to contest. And I think today, and I spend a lot of time discussing this in my classes with my students, it's still there just as much. It's just much more subtle, you know, less overt.
Yeah. But there's still protest. You know, let's talk a little bit more about what they were calling plug uglies. I think that term is so fascinating. Did it specifically have to do with singing commercials or just commercials in general?
I think just commercials in general. Mm-hmm. I mean, there was this recurring critique of excessive advertising on the air. And, you know, I try to make sense of this. I'm never quite sure whether it's the fact that we've just become desensitized or whether these advertisements really were especially obnoxious. I think it's a little bit of both, because if you think about the advent of each new medium, every time advertising first colonizes that new media, whether we're talking about radio or the internet, you know, today people first react against advertisements in their Facebook and Twitter news feeds.
Yeah.
But then eventually they become resigned to what they just think is the new normal. They feel powerless to change it. And so I think that's partly what was happening here, that first people reacted and were just up in arms, and eventually they kind of gave in.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you see it happening now. But I predict in 10 or 20 years, we're going to be appalled that we advertised all these drugs on TV during dinner hour. It's just amazing. Talk about the neighborhood listener councils that started cropping up. People started trying to take these issues into their own hands, right?
That's right. So I like to really point out this model of media activism in the 1940s, because it wasn't all just these social movement groups. It was also just average listeners in local communities that would organize around trying to change their local radio programming. And they would get together and listen to programs together and then actually write letters. They'd have petition campaigns, call-in campaigns to the local radio stations, but also to the FCC. Again, sort of recognizing the policy roots to this particular kind of programming. And they typically would try to say that, you know, this is our airwaves. These are the public airwaves. And we would like to hear more diversity. We'd like to hear coverage of important public affairs, what's going on in our backyards. So, you know, nothing too radical. But usually the broadcasters were not immediately responsive, although I think anecdotally these listener groups had some positive impact on their local programming.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Victor Picard. We're talking about his book, America's Battle for Media Democracy, The Triumph of Corporate Libertarianism, and the Future of Media Reform. You know what I want to talk to you about, too? The FCC and Larry Fly. He was appointed, and he was a progressive, and he didn't get everything done he wanted to. But talk to us about it. He was kind of an unusual character.
Yes, James Lawrence Fly, better known as Larry Fly, not really a household name today, although arguably he is perhaps the most progressive FCC chairman in U.S. history. He was this tough liberal from Texas, which isn't a phrase we hear too often today. But FDR appointed him in the late 30s as kind of a hatchet man. FDR was really concerned about newspaper publishers buying up all the radio stations. Again, you know, we hear concerns about media consolidation, concentration today. This was a major concern in the 40s. And this trope that we hear of today, the liberal media, this was not in circulation in the 1940s. Most people thought of newspaper publishers as being this conservative force in society. When you think of publishers like Hearst and McCormick, they were very anti-New Deal, anti-FDR. So FDR appointed Larry Fly to be this kind of attack dog to make sure that the publishers couldn't take over the airwaves. However, Fly went a little bit rogue once he got there, and he went after radio monopolies the first thing. He was kind of this anti-monopoly crusader.
They didn't want newspapers to own the radio stations right in the same town.
That's right. Yeah, that was a major, that was just a general New Deal concern. FDR cared about that. But, it, you know, even on the cover of my book, you've got this picture of it's the classic, iconic fireside chat with FDR speaking directly in CBS, NBC microphones. So, and that sort of signifies that FDR had a bit of a cozy relationship. I mean, he wasn't happy about these monopolies having so much power, but still, they gave him a sort of megaphone, a loudspeaker to the public that he was actually able to circumvent newspapers by speaking directly to them through radio. And so he wasn't eager to upset these radio monopolies. But Larry Fly sort of took matters into his own hand. In fact, I even found letters in the archives where Larry Fly essentially said it was too late. He had already launched this study on the monopolies that saw that there was no, virtually little competition in radio markets across the country. And basically, this led to breaking up one of the radio monopolies, NBC, breaking it into two, which is actually how we got ABC. Now, I mean, this is beyond comprehension today. This would be like Tom Wheeler, today's FCC chairman, breaking up Comcast, you know, splitting it into two. It's something that doesn't happen today, but this is what the FCC was doing in the 1940s.
Yeah. And the monopoly problem has gotten even worse.
In many ways, it has.
It's impossible. You know, it's impossible even on local radio stations for, you know, little voices to get programs put on the air, you know? It has to be a student radio station or an amateur radio station. Mm-hmm. You know, we've got the same problems that
that what this history shows that it wasn't inevitable. I mean, there were these alternative trajectories, and I really think if the anti-communist hysteria hadn't crept in or blown up when it did in the 1940s, we arguably would have a very different media system today. But because the industry groups were able to say, you know, these FCC commissioners are all commies and they're part of this socialistic cabal, they were able to dismiss them and marginalize them.
And we're still doing that today about, you know, in certain arenas in the culture.
Yeah.
You scream socialism and we're supposed to all run away.
Yeah. Although, I don't, you know, with today's Bernie Sanders campaign, I'm not sure it still holds the same kind of power, but there's still coded language. Like around media reform issues, you'll hear conservatives say, oh, this is a fairness doctrine for the internet. And I think the term fairness doctrine, which is one of the policies that came out of the 40s, is now used as coded language as like big government, you know, government trying to take over our media system.
Yeah,
so still similar code words, if they're not saying socialism.
Yeah. And that's what, you know, I mean, we hold up the BBC as this incredible broadcasting vehicle, and it was taken over by the government.
Yes, in many ways, although it's indirect. I mean, it's subsidized by the government, but, you know, there are these safeguards and firewalls put in between. And, you know, I would love to see an American BBC in this country. I don't think it's too late to to fight for it, even though it seems like politically a non-starter at the moment. But at the very least, we should be trying to fund our public media better. And that's one of my conclusions in the book, is that, you know, all the problems that's facing our media system today, loss of journalism, we really need to look at creative ways for government indirectly, I mean, more it's citizens through government subsidizing their public media system.
Yeah, yeah.
Today, Americans pay about per capita $3 per year in taxes for their public media system. In Britain and in many of the Western and Northern European countries, it's $100 or more.
God, people would say, we're trying. We've got the PBS NewsHour.
Yes.
You know?
It's something. It's something.
It
but ideally,
we need serious news in this country. I mean, when you look around at what's happening, even with this current election,
absolutely,
you see that people don't have the information that they need to make a really smart decision about people.
It's true. I agree. The information is not there. And also, you know, there's often this assumption or this mistaken assumption that because Donald Trump is on television all the time, that's what the people want. You know, they're just giving people what they want. That's not really true. I mean, there's a commercial logic that's driving this. Trump is raising tremendous amounts of money through advertising revenue for these media companies. CBS has been Les Moonves said it might not be good for America, but it's damn good for CBS. That might be the title of my next book. But so I think that really speaks to this.
If you're allowed
disconnect.
To write it.
That's right. Right.
But before we run out of time, I want to talk about the Blue Book that was
yes.
that was a big deal there for a while. Talk to us about what it was, you know, the privilege of holding a license.
Yeah, so that doesn't sound too radical, but based on this idea that these broadcasters have monopolistic use to these licenses of using the public airwaves, that they should be socially responsible, and that each time they come up for their license renewal, as a society, we should evaluate their performance and decide whether they deserve to hold on to that license. And the Blue Book meant to set up these meaningful public interest obligations, like cutting down on excessive advertising. You know, many things we've been talking about, devoting a certain amount of time to local public affairs and educational fare. This was something that people thought was fairly, you know, was fair, was reasonable. But broadcasters reacted to it as if it were a life and death issue. And again, you know, many of these criticisms we're talking about today with like nonstop Trump coverage and nonstop advertising, arguably this would not be the case had the Blue Book gone into effect. But it was red baited like so many of these other reform efforts in the 1940s and has now been all but forgotten. Its official title was Public Service Responsibilities of Broadcast Licensees, but it had a blue cover, which is why it became known as the Blue Book.
Yeah, I remember early on hearing about the Blue Book. To talk to us really quick about the fairness doctrine. I know it was repealed finally, but
yeah, well, so it's sort of ironic. Today it's held up by progressives as this kind of high watermark for progressive media policymaking, but in fact it was a kind of consolation prize. At the end of the 40s, they ended up repealing what had been a stronger regulation known as the Mayflower Doctrine, which prevented broadcasters from politically editorializing, the idea that they shouldn't monopolize political discourse. And in its place, we eventually got what's now known as the Fairness Doctrine, which people conflate it with equal time, this idea that you need to give you know, both sides, as if there's only two sides to an issue, equal amount of time. But that's actually something completely different. The Fairness Doctrine was about covering controversial, important issues that local communities wanted to hear and to do so in a balanced manner. So it's really that first part, this sort of mandate to go into communities and find out, you know, what are the issues that they want to hear? And we need to really try to cover that from all angles. That's the part that we've often forgotten about. But it was this really affirmative idea that, you know, broadcasters need to serve the community, need to play this role in a democratic society.
Yeah, yeah. And your book does talk about the red baiting, how it changed everything. And we're still dealing with it.
Yeah, yeah.
Because people are still red baiting in some ways.
They are. They are. And now even today, if you say things that you might recall in the last year, there was this big debate about net neutrality. This is about internet policy and that your internet service provider shouldn't slow down or block your internet content. And again, this idea, although they, for the moment, have not been successful, but the anti-net neutrality forces tried to say this was a fairness doctrine for the internet, and you know, really tried to say, oh, they're just for big government taking over our internet, when it's nothing of the case. In fact, it's really trying to prevent big corporations from taking over the internet.
Yeah. Well, what do you think some of those reformers like Fly in the 1940s would think about Fox News, MSNBC? You know, obviously they all have an agenda.
Yes.
And they're not even trying to hide it or be fair.
Yeah, I think there would probably be a three-pronged attack. At least someone like Larry Fly would do this. First, try to break up some of these media monopolies. Second, try to enforce meaningful public interest obligations, you know, whether we're talking about bringing back the Fairness Doctrine or, you know, some other kind of programming, public interest protection. And then third, really try to build up our public media system so that we have a structural alternative to this corporate-dominated commercial media system. I think that would be his approach.
Ah, gosh, I wish he was here.
Yes.
let's leap to the new frontier that we're in right now with the, sure, with the, you know, the internet and the digital media. Talk to us about where you think all this is going to be going. You talk a little bit about it in the book.
Yeah, well, I think there are two big areas of concern right now. One would be this era of new digital monopolies, new internet monopolies. And whether we're talking about our internet service providers like Comcast and Time Warner, you may have seen the news that Time Warner and Charter just merged or got permission from the FCC to merge this week. So in many cases, we're talking about duopolies dominating our internet services. Then also you've got Google's, Facebook's, you know, Amazon's, these big sort of content companies that are monopolizing big swaths of the internet. The other area of concern is about the future of journalism, because it's really not being supported. The business model for commercial journalism has collapsed. So we're really going to have to try to find nonprofit, non-commercial alternatives if we're going to have meaningful public interest journalism into the future.
Yeah, yeah. We're going to have to go back to the grassroots and have
Absolutely.
The people who listen to these and consume these programs have to insist.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. There has to be a grassroots movement behind this. It always needs to be bottom up. I mean, we need help from the top. We need progressive policymakers in key positions and major institutions, but it always has to be driven by these kind of social movements at the grassroots. And that's something that I think my history really tries to show, that you need this activism to drive it, to have a more democratic media system.
Yeah, yeah. The public service versus the bottom line, you know, the money is still the major enforcer in our media culture, which is amazing to me.
Yeah.
It's like there's a lack of imagination.
Yeah, it's as true today as it was in the 1940s, and I agree, in some ways even more pronounced. I mean, as we go online now, it's all about clickbait and, you know, just trying to get people to be exposed to different kinds of advertisements. And this commercial logic is very pernicious if we believe in having a marketplace of ideas where everyone can communicate freely and get very rich information.
Yeah, yeah. And I'm worried about the lack of focus in the 140 character communications, which is not going to bring us deep thought about anything in this culture right now. Well, Victor, we're almost out of time. Do you have any contact information, how people can get your book? Are you giving any readings in the next few months?
Sure. Right now, I don't have any more readings scheduled. I've been giving a bunch all over the place, but I'm very easy to find online. I'm on Twitter at VW Picard, and my book is sold everywhere. So everywhere online, that is. So yeah, please reach out to me. I'm always happy to talk about these things.
Great. Well, Victor Picard, thank you so much for joining us. Again, the book is called America's Battle for Media Democracy, The Triumph of Corporate Libertarianism and the Future of Media Reform. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me on the show, Tish.
Our audio producer is Nate Richardson at Rep Studio in Ithaca, New York. Our theme music was composed by Diego Vega. And we are a sponsored project of the New York Foundation for the Arts. Tax-deductible donations are welcome at artspire.org. That's artspire.org. And visit us online at outofboundsradioshow.com. I'm Tish Perlman. We'll be back next week.